Okay, we're back underway. Commissioner Smith.
Hello, thank you. Can you hear me? Thank you, Sarah. I just wanted to explore a couple of things that came up in the 42A report. One in section page 8, 3.15, the submitter makes a point that you didn't take an expert-based system approach to this, and I just want to explore that a little bit in that when you were developing the zone rules or the Wahitapuna rules, what expert advice were you reliant on, and what expert evidence, I suppose, supported the mapping in particular as a basis for this section?
So the mapping was based on what was informed by Mana Whenua, them being the holders of that knowledge of what is significant to them, and then undertook to then figure out how to incorporate that into the provisions of the PDP from a planning point of view.
So you took a sort of pretty consultative, I'm not sure your microphone's on, by the way.
Yeah.
You took a consultative approach to this, and I'm just interested, in the case of a landscape-driven plan change, you would clearly have a landscape expert providing and providing the report. Are you suggesting that you've relied purely on Mana Whenua for the expert advice in that case?
They essentially are the expert as the holder of that knowledge.
Okay, so this point goes on to say that those people aren't the Mana Whenua advisors aren't necessarily required to be qualified or experienced in the same way that other experts might be in this context. Is that's correct?
It's not something that you can gain a university qualification for. It's reliant on your connection to Mana Whenua.
So when we're moving forward with this, council haven't sought to present expert evidence on these issues in its own right?
No, we haven't. So we worked together with Okaha in developing, but we haven't got expert evidence from them as such.
So you're relying completely on the submissions of Runaka, to provide the evidentiary basis for this?
Correct.
And will, given that they're not expert, they're not presenting as experts as such, will they be sort of subject to the same requirements of experts of other matters under the guidelines of the court?
Some of their evidence includes expert evidence. The likes of Mr. Bathgate, he's submitting as a planning evidence.
Planning evidence, yeah. But we don't have a cultural expert witness as such. We've got we have the advice of the Mana Whenua through the submission. Is that correct?
Okay.
Do you see any limitations of that as a, I suppose, a model in informing a plan change like this?
Sorry, what was the question again?
Do you see any limitations of that in informing a plan change like this, of taking that approach, of relying on a submitter rather than an expert?
No. I think the discussions were that think we've got the evidence, and certainly the discussions were that they were wanting to put submissions in as well. So there's always a tension between if council called them for evidence, that might cause issues for them to be able to submit as well.
Yeah. Procedurally, you can imagine there might be some limitations that other submitters might not have the opportunity to hear those submissions before they, or the experts before they make their submission, and equally council's closing might not have the benefit of being able to use their experts to inform changes to the provisions in the closing, council's closing.
I think that the relationship has been clear all along that will come through. So,
all right, that's fine. I'll just leave that one there. I just wanted to run through briefly some notes I've got here around. You've identified forestry as a threat, and an incompatible activity. In a case where exotic trees exist on a site that's been mapped as Wahi Tupuna, is the removal of those trees a threat? Or is the establishment of the forestry a threat?
It's the establishment.
Is it worth...
Noting also that there is quite specific provisions in the NES around forestry and definition.
Okay. Can you expand any more on commercial and commercial recreation activities as a threat? Obviously, there's a huge scope to that, right from a kayak operator on the lake around Mawahu. Is that I'm not sure. Is that a threat to the values versus a commercial fishing operation or something?
I suppose one thing in relation to that, and you quite commonly see, is conditions for, say, a commercial boating operation on the lakes or where you've got, say, on the islands, is that there's quite often conditions around making sure that information around the stories is told correctly, disposal of waste and things like that is considered. So there can be a number of factors that come in.
Okay. And so 39.4.1 relates to the distance of new farm buildings from existing farm buildings. Can you just explain to me what relevance the distance of a building from another building has to the potential impact on the values?
So I have amended that based on the evidence of Mr. Bathgate, and he's confirmed that sort of where buildings were essentially co-locating, that they could accept that the effects were likely to be less than, say, new buildings in those areas above the 400 metres above sea level. I haven't taken the full extent of the rule as Mr. Bathgate drafted it. I've taken out the aspect that essentially was existing use rights, because that's covered and it can become complicated if you include that. Section 10 is what it is in terms of existing use rights.
Okay, and further down that page, 39.5XX, you've got one that relates to skylines when viewed from formed roads or adjoining sites. Can you just explain to me why, what the relevance, in, given that this isn't like landscape assessment as such, which is clearly where those types of provisions are have usually been used, can you explain to me what the relevance of a property boundary has to the Manawatu value, or the Wahitapuna value in that case? The visibility from a property boundary or a public or a paper road?
So my reading of that is that you've got the... it's around viewpoints. You've always got to define an area in some way. So adjoining sites.
So it's a suggestion that the visibility is the thing that impacts on the value, on the cultural value, as opposed to the presence of it.
Correct, and I believe that I can't remember if it was Mr. Bathgate's or Mr. Ellison's evidence included comments around that sort of visibility, and it's also, you know, views to and from Wahitupuna areas and how that can be impacted by some development.
Is that crossing into landscape space, do you think, or do you think it is a distinctly cultural value?
I think it's a cultural value. I think landscapes can include cultural values, but cultural values don't necessarily include landscape.
Going on to the identification of values on 39-8, number five, you've got what I read as something that is described as values relating to Mahinahika Kai on the Clutha River. So it talks about weka eels and cabbage trees and various things. So presumably it's predominantly a value around food resource. I just wonder if you could explain to me how F relates to, could be associated with that, given that it talks about upper slopes and ridge lines. Is there, it feels to me those two things are somewhat separate, the values around the river versus the values of the upper slopes and the ridge lines.
I wonder, Commissioner, if that's a question you should ask Mr. Ellison. Not this minute, but on the 21st.
Yeah, thank you.
By which time you'll have the answer for you.
I'll flag that and we can talk about that later on, that's fine. And yeah, that's probably all for now. I just also acknowledge that both in the case of Wanaka and in the case of Queenstown, the level of development around the urban areas has effectively cancelled out the need to protect those values. Is that how I read those?
Yes.
Okay. That's all for now. Thank you.
Commissioner Dawson.
Yes, I've got a few questions for you, and then I'll lead over to Commissioner Hill, sort of, because some of them will be on similar lines. I've got some broader questions first, and then I'll hone into the wording of the policies and the rules. Firstly, an easy question, just so I'm clear. The zones that are included in the urban environment, so that includes the large lot residential zone?
Correct.
But it doesn't include the rural lifestyle or the rural residential?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Or the Wakatip Basin lifestyle precinct?
Correct.
Right. Okay, thank you. Now, this is sort of a broader question. The Wahitupuna sites are large sites. Quite large sites, and they've been specifically broadly defined, and I understand the reasons that you and the Runaka evidence are given for that, so that they capture possibilities of activities that might threaten the values without being too specific and honing in on little sites. And there's also a very wide list of potential threats. I mean, some of them have got I mean, some of them you'd think, well, are there any other activities that could possibly happen that aren't captured by that list? And even with Mr. Bathgate's suggested amendments, there's still quite a wide range of, and this is what some of the submitters are saying, a wide range of everyday regular farming activities, for example, that could get captured by these rules. So can you explain to me, and I may be able to have found this out by reading it properly myself, but can you just explain what the council did in terms of a Section 32 evaluation to weigh up the costs and benefits, the efficiency and appropriateness of coming to the rules in this and the provisions of this chapter? Now, I know that Ms. Scott has covered why they were quantitatively analysed, and I'm not talking about quantitative analysis, I'm talking about just weighing up. But what did the council do?
So these activities were informed by Mana Whenua. There was some discussion that went on in terms of making sure that there was understanding from how those activities function in the district plan. The starting point that we had is that there are some discretionary rules in the PDP to start with that capture development. So there's the Chapter 26 development in a Wahi Tupuna rule, so discretionary rule, and also the earthworks rule was discretionary as well. So I suppose that there was some consideration, but with that baseline being that there was a discretionary regime essentially in the...
Which are the ones that are being replaced by this?
Correct.
So both in the subdivision and development chapter and the earthworks chapter, those...
And the historic heritage chapter
as
well.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that just related more to a Kuiwi Tangata or an archaeological site, doesn't it? Or
It was a discretionary rule that captured development. I suppose through the review it was noted that development is quite a broad term, to define it could have issues and implications in other areas of the plan as well, so that certainly was where we wanted to be a little bit more refined, albeit that we still have a broad...
So were the options that you considered in terms of weighing up costs and benefits were not against a blank slate of no provisions? I mean, did you weigh these provisions against what was already in the PDP? How did you go about that? Or did you look at the option of having different provisions altogether than what you've ended up with?
The main focus... I can perhaps pull up my Section 32 to, but certainly the main focus was on what the status quo, and then developing the set of provisions that we had. That was the main focus. But
I mean, for example, some of the submitters have said that the rules shouldn't be applied to permissive activities, and they, I think, mentioned Dunedin or something where a similar process has got. Well, mapping's gone through, but I might be wrong with what I recall, but that activities that were otherwise permissive wouldn't get captured, but the Wahi Tupuna site rules are applied to anything that would otherwise get a resource consent. I mean, did you look at that as one of your alternatives?
Certainly, in coming up with the provisions, we started with that concept of the DCC proposal. There were some quite varied differences. The volumes that apply, say, for earthworks in Dunedin are at a very different scale from our provisions.
Smaller.
Much smaller. Mm-hmm. So we enable a lot. So did consider against applying the volumes versus the status quo, which was this discretionary rule, versus coming up with something different.
And how did you evaluate the costs to landowners? I mean, I'm not asking how you weighed that against the cultural values, because I understand that has to be done, but how did you come up with at least a broad understanding of the costs of the various options that you were looking at?
So the broad understanding was based on consent, especially consent initial fees. It's always quite difficult because certainly it's my experience processing resource consents in QLDC. It's very rare for a consent to be on one single rule. Like, often you can have pages of rules that you're dealing with. But looked at initial fees, looked at costs for notification, discussed to some extent the costs of consultation, having been advised about the sort of typical type of application that Ōkaha receive, that a lot of it comes down to additional cost of consultation, but there was also discussion of if you ended up in limited notification, you may have additional fees to pay for that.
Okay. So now I'm going to just look more specifically at policy 32213 and 39214. And this is really diving into some words here now. Some of the submitters have honed in on this word certain, recognise that certain activities. And that, I mean, to me it jumped out as being an unusual word to have. Because you've just in the policy above listed a whole list of activities, or and in the previous policy, of activities that may be incompatible with mana whenua values. But then you say, well, certain ones can have significant adverse effects. So, I mean, I wonder why do you need that word? If it wasn't there at all, wouldn't it say exactly the same, and it wouldn't raise the same problems that people say, well, what does certain mean? What are to the certain ones?
I accept that, yes.
Yeah, okay. And then it goes on to say, well, activities can have significant adverse effects. Well, okay. And you've changed should to must. So what do you see as the difference between those two words, and why have you changed them?
So should, I don't think is necessarily that the it would usually be shall instead of should.
Yes.
would be the usual.
Yes.
Must was ORC put that forward in their submission.
How does it relate to what's in the RPS? Because they have something similar,
I believe it, I'd have to pull the RPS up, but I believe it's consistent with that.
The must has come from there. Yeah.
Just while you're thinking about that, Commissioner, I think the RPS has something like avoid significant adverse effects on values contributing to Wahi Tupuna, which, so on one hand it's directive, but on the other hand it's carving out in a different direction by saying it's only some significant effects. So you've only picked up half of it.
Yes, I mean, the way I think that's right. I mean, the way I read it, they avoid using one of those words. But I mean, shall is often a more common word to be used. I just think, I mean, you need to be careful jumping from one word to another and have a very good reason for it. My fellow commissioners just pointed out, I mean, you say recognise that certain activities have adverse effects. So you're talking about activities having significant adverse effects. Is it the activities that must be avoided or the adverse effects that must be avoided?
It's the adverse effects.
Yes. And then you go on in the next policy, which is sort of a linking one, because then it says avoid, remove or mitigate any other adverse effects of activities, I presume. And I presume that the word other means those that aren't significant in the one above.
Correct.
And so you have, I mean, what I'm saying is I think you sort of need to make assumptions between all of those policies, like you assume what certain means, you assume that it's the adverse effects that it'll be avoided, you have to assume that other adverse effects are the ones that aren't mentioned in the one above or the one above that. It may be that linking those two policies, 3 and 4, do you think, I mean, I know you've said no, you don't think that's necessary, but would it not clarify the relationship between those two policies if they were written as a nice little package? I think it's at ORC that's asked for that.
I suppose I took a fairly neutral approach to that. I could see that there certainly isn't anything that would, that I can see that I think should prevent that from happening. So I could accept that it could work together as well.
So if by any chance you were sent away to do a bit of work on these policies, that could be something that you might look at. Now, just looking at a couple of the rules, you've picked up some wording from Mr. Bartgate on buildings that don't affect the skyline. And I just wonder if you've really investigated how certain that rule is, 939.5XX, shall not modify a skyline or terrace when viewed from an adjoining site. Given that some of these adjoining sites are enormous in the rural area, if a site means an ownership or property title, are you sure that you can with certainty determine whether something is on a skyline or not when you have to consider every part of the adjoining property? I mean, if you wandered around enough, you could probably find a skyline from somewhere. I mean, those sort of rules, I mean, I'm not saying this to be facetious, because those sort of rules are notoriously difficult to apply in practice. And I just wonder whether you've turned your mind to that, or whether there are other rules in the plan that work perfectly that are written just like that at the moment. I mean, you've sort of picked this up from Mr. Bathgate, but I just want to make sure that you yourself have turned your mind to the practicality of applying some of these rules. I mean, can you say that you have?
I mean, certainly it is. I'm aware that there can be challenges, but it's also. I think certainly it's something that gets considered for the likes of landscape, perhaps.
Well,
not
often within a discretionary context, as a matter of discretion, as opposed to a rule.
This does call back to. I suppose it does then lie somewhat on mana whenua also being able to be confident in knowing those skylines and ridge lines of importance because it does call back.
But those aren't identified in the plan, are they? No. That's going to rely on a discretionary interpretation. Okay. And then my last question is about the 10 square metres for earthworks. I mean, I understand that it's come back a long
way.
Cubic metres. Sorry, cubic metres. Come back a long way from the 1,000 cubic metres in the rural zone. Do you see that these wahitūpuna are being more akin to, if you look at the scale of them, an ONF versus an ONL? Because in an ONL, there are no separate earthworks volumes, as I can see. It just relies on the rural one, because a lot of the rural area is ONL. Whereas the one that you pointed to before in your discussion was an ONF, which is 10 cubic metres.
I'm always hesitant to compare cultural rules.
I'm not wanting you to compare the values. I'm just sort of talking about the scale and the implications of the effects. I mean, how did the... Because when we were asked about the 10 cubic metres before, you mentioned, oh, well, it's similar to what's there for an ONF.
So, yeah. I mean, an ONF that is... So one of the things for an ONF is the visual effects is often a big one. I mean, the range of effects can be quite varies for cultural values, both and the because you could be dealing with quite a broad scale or quite a specific scale, and it's really going to be very dependent on the what's being proposed. And in some areas it might be that the visual effects are more important, in other areas it might actually be the, you know, just the disturbance that's important. That there's quite a variety, and we looked at the permitted volumes in the zones, and they are quite, you know, some of those volumes are quite large. I suppose started at a point of like what the, I suppose, zero volume, which is essentially what the discretionary is now, and the 10 cubic metres was landed on as it had that consistency with the historic heritage and the ONF, but scale, it's apples and oranges in some ways in terms of comparing scale.
Yes, okay. All right, thank you.
Commissioner Hill.
I've only got two. Thank you, the other commissioners, for picking those up. And the questions really go to language and how directive these provisions are and how they would assist the decision maker. And when I read the objective, talk about recognising the five.
Am I
hearing? I can hear you. I'll speak up.
Hey, it's more important that Katkin is recording you.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Start again. So the questions I've really got are around language and how directive or how helpful these provisions would be to a decision maker. And in the objective, you know, it's got that language of recognise and provide for, which I understand is that's the Section 6 language coming through. In the policies, there's a lot of recognising going on, and I'm just wondering what the basis of that was and whether that's actually necessary and helpful. But equally, the other policies, that the first one talks about those activities may be incompatible, and the same as the next policy, may be incompatible. And this might be slightly rhetorical because you might be coming back with somewhere. How does that actually assist an applicant when making it and the decision maker in assessing it and doing a determination, as I read them, it sort of says recognise that they may have an effect. Well, I'm not sure where that takes you. So I just pose that as a broader question, and Karunaka might want to address that when they give their evidence. But do you just want to make any response to that?
I suppose the key direction that was trying to set out is that, and the use of may was to really truly understand that, you would need to go to mana whenua to understand. And there's always a tension of trying to provide enough certainty in a plan, but also recognise that there's a complex relationship of values, and so that recognition to really encourage and direct consultation is really necessary in these situations.
Now, I think that's reading between the lines that I was reading. That's what they were intended to do, and I understand that. But I suppose kind of how that is actually going to be helpful to a decision maker. So I'll just leave that with you. But in the second set of questions, come to those next set of policies, 5, 6, and to a degree 7, about encouraging consultation, talking about CIAs. I understand them, there's probably no harm in them. They read more as methods to me and not as policies, and I just invite you to make a comment on that.
I suppose, yes, you could take those as methods. Some of the reason for having them there as well is to try and give them visibility.
I thank you for that. That's what I thought.
Opening point, something for you to go and have a look at. When I was reading Schedule 6, I pulled up the viewer and find out where are all these locations. And I found that all but about half a dozen are wrongly numbered in the viewer. They do not match what's in the schedule. They're all offset by one. So that's just something that needs to be cleaned up within the council system, can I suggest? The suggested additions to section 39.3, I think that page 39.3, is there a problem that the clarification about what the environment means, the urban environment means, is under heading interpreting and applying the rules, when I think that it's also about interpreting and applying the objectives and policies?
I accept that it does specify the rules, so whilst you get direction for the rules, it doesn't give you direction for the policies.
Might be an idea to put it in the purpose statement up front. Next, a personal request. I'll talk to the commissioners about that, but it would assist me greatly if you could supply us with topographical maps with the way Tupuna entered them. You can look at the viewer, but you have no sense of the landscape looking at the viewer. The other thing I'd be grateful if you could investigate, please. Mr. Bathgate suggested an exemption below 400 MASL. I think at least one planner suggested 500 as a trigger. I think in the plan currently uses 600 MASL as a trigger for some rules. Do you think you could give us some topographical maps that identify what's the difference? What land is between 400 and 500? What land is between 500 and 600 MASL? Because I think Mr. Edgar told us most of the floor of the Cadrona Valley is above 400 and below 500, but I'm interested more broadly.
Yes, we will be able to put a topographical map as a layer that can be switched on and off in the web viewer very easily.
Looking at 3.15, when I was taught rules of argument, I was told about straw men in this politically conscious age. We might just call them straw people. Talking about mana whenua may belong to multiple iwi or hapu is certainly something that may apply in the North Island, but I don't think we're under any illusions that the relevant iwi and hapu are the ones sitting immediately behind you. And I don't think it's very helpful to just observe that and I'd invite you to reflect on the point.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to clarify which provision you were referring to.
Paragraph 3.15 of 42A response. Wondering about the approach to policy talking about consult, and if you don't consult, get a CIA. I'd always been under the impression that the only way you could write a robust CIA was by talking to the Tangata Whenua. And so is this becoming like it's not just about consultation with Tangata Whenua, but that's the starting point. So how does that work? How is a CIA an alternative to consultation?
So the CIA would be an option available under 92.2 to commissioner reports. Say if a application came in and there was no consultation, but it was considered that there were values that needed to be considered, and it's not that. So a CIA usually would be for the more larger scale or more complex resource consents that a CIA would come into play.
Same page, your discussion of timeframes and costs starting at 3.34. This is a question I'll ask the Runaka, but in terms of the efficiency and practicability of these provisions, has the Council considered whether Okaha has the resources to participate in the process that these provisions set up, or whether it will be drowned under a deluge of people wanting to consult, having been, or people who have been directed by these provisions to consult, and that the provisions may grind to a halt in practice?
That was certainly discussions that occurs in developing these, and it was certainly something that was addressed when we had the public consultation sessions, and in particular for Okaha, my understanding is that they've taken on more staff at Okaha in recent times with these types of provisions coming in for DCC and other areas, and so there's been an awareness on both sides of resourcing, and certainly that the discussion has been that comfortable that resourcing is available.
The questions that Commissioner Dawson was asking you about scale, she was comparing an ONF to an ONL, and you said, well, it's not apples and apples. I had a different scale in my head, and that is that these provisions, as you recommended be modified, will apply, for instance, 10 cubic metres to a single rural residential site of 4,000 square metres. Well, they could be applying to a station that could be 5,000 hectares. And the practicality of a 10 cubic metre limit to one is entirely different to the other. Is there room, in your mind, and I'm going to ask the Rudaka the same question, and the reason I'm asking you is so they can be thinking about it in the meantime, is there room to make a proportionate 10 cubic metres per 5,000 square metres, for example, if you say that if you're starting on the premise that 10 cubic metres is the right number for a rural residential section. So that's an open question. Would a rule like that be able to be enforced?
I would say yes, and there is some similarity that's similar to the approach that Dunedin City Council takes for their volumes for earthworks. It's volumes per area rather than the QLDC permitted volumes approach, which is just a volume per site.
Go to 8.7, please. Two questions arising from this. There is a suggestion in the planning evidence, and I've forgotten whose planning evidence it is, that there should be a further exemption for earthworks within an approved building platform. What's your view of that?
It's one of the places where there is tension between some of those areas clearly hold significance for Mana Whenua, and the volume of earthworks has been discussed as below that there would be a level of comfort, but above that there could be adverse effects. So certainly for some of those areas, I suppose what comes to mind is Punatapu does have rural living in it, so but that is one of the areas where they've specifically stated that they would like that volume to be retained. So there is a tension between obviously understanding that there is an element of development anticipated, but there could be some effects from earthworks associated with that development.
The other question in 8.7 is, can you explain to me how a lapsed consent to act can add complexity? To my mind, a lapsed consent is a nothing. It's like the ex-parrot.
I seem to remember that the intention of what I was writing there is that it can cause quite a few issues in terms of timing. So when things lapse, agreed, a lapsed consent is a lapsed consent. It's no longer a consent. But that timing issue is really where it can...
Before it's lapsed,
yeah.
Basically. Question about the overlap between statutory acknowledgement areas and the provisions that are pulled in by the Treaty Settlement Act that relate to those provisions, and the overlap with these Wahi Tupuna provisions. I think Mr. Devlin makes a strong argument that in Section 32 terms that duplication is unsatisfactory, inefficient. He uses a number of other adjectives, to be fair. What is the rationale from your point of view of providing in Chapter 39 for statutory acknowledgement areas as well as the existing provisions that already exist and are mandated by the, as I say, the Treaty Settlement Act?
The settlement is a piece of legislation in itself. We're specifically dealing with how land uses, and I think it is part of the picture of the overall area. So I don't think it adds complexity in any way. It just reinforces.
Well, on the face of it, if there are two sets of plan provisions, both governing activities within the same area for the same purpose, isn't that adding complexity?
Can I ask, what rules are there in the plan, if any, that relate to the statutory acknowledgement area?
25.4.6,
which aren't being removed, so that's not being removed by this chapter.
Correct.
No.
Which is full discretionary.
And it's earthworks.
Yes.
Correct.
So, as I say, aren't we adding a layer of complexity?
I just noted when Chima was talking about consented building platforms, that a building platform is a full discretionary as well. So
correct.
All cultural values that could be taken into account.
Correct.
Up to the square meterage of a building platform.
Mm. suppose the question to follow up is, how confident can we be that for existing building platforms that has actually occurred? Given that they sit on the title and may have been there for years.
I would perhaps say on the lower level of confidence.
go back to my original, where I started. So, is this a level of complexity? Is there a way to make it less complex without losing the force of the provisions or the intent of the provisions?
I suppose when you're looking at the set of provisions and specifically what's needing to be looked at, the restricted discretionary, as with the other rules that have been proposed, could be applied for those specific areas, making it the cultural values of Mana Whenua being the matter that is of specific discretion that needs to be looked at in relation to those statutory acknowledgement areas.
Thank you very much, Ms. Pickard. I just checked Commissioner Cheatham, since she's going to do a runner on us, whether she has anything left.
I just wanted to just clarify between the opening legal submissions and your summary, whether there was movement on the from your perspective on the mapping of the urban Wāhi Tūpuna. Because I think Chapter 5 does refer to, you know, kaitahu presence in the built environment, so there seems to be a sort of foundation for recognising that there are wāhi tūpuna in the urban areas, but there may not be room for whatever associated them because of the level of development. Are you looking at moving on that position as well? Or?
I suppose the area of difference is the mapping of them, because we had they were specifically excluded in the maps that were notified. However, they are included in that schedule, and there are no rules that specifically get triggered for that. And we also have the policies in most of those town centres that talk about making sure those values are integrated into sort of the urban environment as well. I can't remember the exact wording, but there are some policies within those town centres, sort of more about positively contributing rather than activities necessarily having adverse effects.
So you don't think they need to be met, you think there's enough in there?
Correct.
I have one follow-up question that I'd forgotten to ask you. Policy 5.4.5.1 reads, identify Wāhi Tūpuna and all their components on the district plan maps in order to facilitate their protection from the adverse effects of suburbs nuisance development. These maps map the Wāhi Tūpuna, but I don't think they map their components. So is that a job to come? Or is the job to come a variation to that policy?
Is that a good Was that a reference to chapter 5?
Yes, chapter 5.4.5.1.
That would need to be tidied up.
Do you think the tidying is an additional set of maps or a small deletion from chapter 5?
I would hope that we can have the Wahitu Puna identified and so that we could take that out.
But it's the components within the Wahitu Puna. I think the message I've got loud and long from Karunaka is that they don't want to get too specific within these broad areas. So that would suggest that it's the policy in Chapter 5 that needs to change rather than the maps, to me, at least. But I'm going to ask them that question too.
Okay.
What's your view?
I'll just pull up the... Components is not necessarily specific there. I think once we have the Wahitu Puna identified and we're identifying threats as well, that we could change that. I think you can take the components to be sort of the values and threats that are scheduled, but it's not.
Yeah, they haven't been mapped. Well,
we're thinking about
something for you to ponder.
Sure.
Well, thank you, Ms. Pickard. Ms. Scott, I think we probably have time for your submissions.
Well, what I was thinking of doing, I just want to make one comment before we wrap up. That on Hearing Stream 16, there was a suggestion from Commissioner Smith that we didn't have any expert cultural evidence. I'm sure Mr. Enright will make this submission, but mine is that we do. My submission is that we do have cultural expert evidence from Mr. Allison, also from Mr. David Higgins, I think also Miss Lynette Carter, but I just wanted to foreshadow that. I'm sure it will come from my friends in any event.
And Mr. Enright could be ready to explain why they haven't subscribed to the code of experts.
Some have, some haven't.
Yes, I looked that up while we were discussing it.
I just wanted to get that
yes,
on the record.
I understand that point.
What I was going to do, so my legal submissions don't touch on the design guides at all. Mr. Munro looks like he wants to
he's chapping,
get interested.
He's chapping.
I was
just
wondering,
how I look.
I was wondering whether, given that we have Mr. Comptamon and Mr. Devlin here, whether we get through that evidence now.
No, that won't happen.
Oh, okay. Too many
what
questions.
Time did you think we were going to finish?
5.
No, that won't happen. I have some questions for you to
okay.
understand the council's understanding of what is proposed. But I was going to first suggest to the chair that we might have a sidebar as to whether it's best to just start 15 minutes earlier tomorrow and just roll through continuously rather than do 15 minutes now and then stop. Or just stay later.
What I could do is do the general submissions on Hearing Stream 17 and 18 now.
I think that
if you like.
Would usefully use the time in that way. and then kick off first thing in the morning, perhaps with Mr. Compton on and Mr. Devlin as a tag team operation.
Suit me. Okay. So, turning back to my legal submissions, so I'm in section 6 on page 11. So these, the matters that I'm going to address now are common to hearing streams 17 and 18, hence that why they've been addressed in one section. The first, I just note there, the council's recommended zoning on submissions in the three parks general area, but also the general industrial, they cross over three different section 42As. We've just provided one map which shows the council's position, and it's attached to these legal submissions. I mentioned this morning the approach that the council's taken to rezoning sought on land that wasn't notified in stage 3. This section here simply justifies it from a legal perspective. With your leave, I will take 6.2 through to 6.6 as read.
Can I ask you a question about it? You can certainly take it as read. I want to talk about the application of it.
Yes.
I thought it was interesting that you characterised universal developments as an incidental and consequential extension. That's, I can understand the concept that extending out from an area that's been rezoned low density rural residential, pushing the boundary a bit, might be an incidental change. And we have southern benches at the margins of Albertown that I think you could safely say are basically one line of houses on the other side of the road. I think, yes, that passes the sniff test as being incidental and consultation. But doubling the size of Hawea seems rather a stretch as an incidental and consequential addition.
That is fair. I think it's around 400 hectares. Perhaps I can clarify myself. Some of the zones that are sought by Universal Developments are stage 3 zones. For example, the general industrial zone. So it comes into sort of the second principle there. It is directly adjacent or across the road, across Cemetery Road, from notified land. The question for the council really is, where do you draw a line in terms of what is incidental? And perhaps my submissions are a little bit slip of the tongue there in terms of it falling within Justice Kosher's exception from motor machinist, but when you look at the collection of zones that were sought through Universal Developments in their submission, it wasn't entirely clear at the start what they wanted. They wanted a bunch of urban zones. The council just has simply taken a pragmatic approach and is considering that land. Part of it falls within the second category. It's general industrial. It's a stage 3 zone. Some parts don't.
And I suppose the, I understand the desire for pragmatism. Do you think as a matter of law it's a stretch?
I think if you apply those two factors together, the incidental or consequential extension, as well as the fact that we have these stage 3 zones. And I'm going to add another factor, and it's the complexity around the staged approach to the plan review. Council's approached this from a perspective where we need to take fairness, and I think we need to put some weight on that. Throughout these stages, we've had challenges from various submitters that it hasn't been fair as to when they know if they can submit on their land and that type of thing. So we've got to the point where council has an objective to these submissions for those reasons, including the fairness factor as well.
Another complication, I think it comes in with Art's Point and Cardrona and Hawea, is that although Stage 3 is about settlements, it's reviewing what was the township zone, but it's actually rolled over as zones that were way back in Stage 1. So yes. You might suddenly think, well, why on earth are we looking at low-density zones, local centre shopping zones, right through here in Stage 3? The council's brought that into Stage 3 just through reconsidering some of those township zones.
The council has, and it needed to identify, it, for example, in Stage 1, Stage 2, Stage 3, what land it was reviewing. Mm. And it did that by looking at an ODP zone. Mm. In this situation, it looked at the ODP township zone and assessed it, and based on all of the statutory tests, decided that the current zone, so the ODP township zone, nor the PDP settlement zone, that they were most appropriate. Part of that was to do with the extent of development that's already happened in those places. So they've found the PDP zone that they consider to be most appropriate. But that is relevant in terms of, for example, at Arthur's Point, we do have the residential zones being applied there. So it is complex.
If Universal had come along in Stage 1 and said we want this group of zones over the road from a blank that was Hawea, that wouldn't have been easy for them to convince the council to accept at that stage.
That's correct. Yeah. And for example, they part of it, what they're seeking is a local shopping centre zone. Now we do have I think, beyond appeal zone there. So we've got a lot of certainty around the provisions that we can apply to that land.
Before it was just part of a blank that hadn't been reviewed.
Mm.
Well, another way to look at it was that the ex-township land was directly over the road of the street property, but the zones directly over the road from the Universal property next to it were all Stage 1 zones.
Mm.
So understand the point you make, that going on into your discussion of Corbridge, also understand this point, but I want to put a small variation to you. Obviously Corbridge is seeking a bespoke rural visitor zone. If we thought that the Corbridge submission was meritorious, but that it's not a rural visitor zone, it's a Millbrook-type resort zone, would we have scope to put that in the plan?
My first submission would be that Millbrook's probably not the best zone to look at to start with, but...
You know what I mean. I take your point.
You have Jack's point.
Putting that to one side, the answer is yes, there is scope for some other zone. It needs to sit somewhere between the rural zone, RCL, and the rural visitor zone. With any amendments to that zone that Corbridge sought in their original submission. So there needs to be careful consideration of the spectrum of relief available between those two zones.
Two zones, three.
The rural zone, RCL, and the RVZ, as Corbridge sought in their submission, and I think they sought some site-specific amendments.
But if the submitter has asked, clearly specified in their submission for more lenient or extra or generous or whatever word you like to call it, provisions over and above the RV zone, then that falls within their submission and the scope for
so,
that.
So, yes, I was thinking exactly the same point. So, so if you look at the RV zone as they sought it be tweaked, then well, is your view that a resort zone would be within that?
It needs to be the relief they sought in their submission, not through evidence. That's
yes.
important.
Yeah, we understand the point.
The,
and yes, we will go back and reread the submission.
The second point that I want to make is that a resort zone cannot consist of urban development as defined in the PDP. So there's another question there for Corbridge as to whether what they're proposing is urban development. Obviously not the golf course, but the built part of
in
that.
In that respect, can you tell me, I know that the definition of resort was appealed. I think, was it Trojan Helmet got leave to file a late appeal?
Yes, and they withdrew their appeal.
So?
After that.
Right, so that's the answer. So the definition of resort is as per the Stage 1 decisions?
Yes. Pretty sure that's correct, yes.
Yes, well, that would be a bit hard for...
I will double-check, but I'm sure that's the case.
Well, no, I take it back. If the definition of resort, for the benefit of my colleagues, is something that is principally for visitors, may have a residential component, and is focused on on-site recreational activities.
Do you want to read the definition? Means an integrated and planned development involving low average density of residential development as a portion of the developed area, principally providing temporary visitor accommodation and forming part of an overall development focused on on-site visitor activity.
Like a golf course.
Yeah. A golf course or a subway.
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought we were talking about Melbourne. But
yes.
That's correct. but what is also important is the definition of urban development.
Yes.
So you need to look at both of them. And if anything in that Corbridge proposal meets the definition of urban development, then there's a problem. Because Chapter 4 of the plan, which is subject to the draft consent order not yet issued, provides a bunch of objectives and policies which, in summary, directs urban development inside the urban growth boundaries and avoids urban development outside the urban growth boundaries.
My recollection of the definition of urban development is, but does not include a resort in an otherwise rural area. Which is what the Commissioner just read out. So I started with a scope issue. I think you've told us what the how we should go about looking at that. I suppose my question is, you have discreetly not made a submission as to whether it's within scope, like if you don't feel that you need to, and you leave that to us to take up with the submitter, well, that's fine. But Do you want to make a submission to us? Do you want to tell us it is in or out of scope if they were to go for a resort zone?
A resort zone. I might just wait till we get to hearing stream 18 to make that submission, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Karen, please carry on.
I don't think I've got anything else to add on that scope question. One point. The rural zone RCL is, of course, so the rural zone's a fully discretionary regime. So that's relevant to the question of scope. And this is something that Miss Grace has addressed in her RVZ evidence, and I do turn back, I will come to it later in the week in my legal submissions. But essentially, under that fully discretionary regime, the council already has the ability to provide conditions, etc., around certain built form standards in the rural zone. And that is relevant to the scope that is available to the panel in terms of new rural visitor zones sought in the rural zone, RCL, and the rural zone, ONL.
Can I ask a sort of vaguely related question, but you may want to cover this in Stream 18 or not at all. I puzzled about the scope for asking for RVZ outside the O&L when the purpose of the RVZ is so clearly related to being within the O&L through the purpose and the objectives and policies. They all relate. So you're taking a zone, but asking for it to be applied completely differently.
That's perhaps more a question around policy rather than a pure scope issue. So at the end of the day, a person can make a submission for a zone anywhere. The question then is the merits of what they're asking for. And the RVZ was notified across four locations, all legacy zones that have come across from the ODP essentially, and they are all located in the ONL. The RVZ is drafted in a way that, that the purpose is all about the ONL, the provisions and the policies are about the ONL. So what, I mean, my advice to the council is you can't oppose these on the basis of scope. We need to consider them. The question then is whether the merits stack up. And then what that means, and what that means, well, the first question is whether the rural visitor zone is actually an appropriate zone in that location in the first place, or whether something else is, which is what you're testing, Mr. Chair, about whether some type of resort zone might be something better, which is, you know, we have a special zone being sought through stage two, which consists of a golf course and a bunch of very nice allotments above Glendu Bay. We have Millbrook with its golf course. It's a common theme. We've got Jack's Point. They all sit in the sort of special zone framework.
Brimston Valley now.
Yes. Yeah. Of the PDP. So I mean, from my submission, that goes to whether it's actually the appropriate zone. The evidence from the council is the RVZ is not the right zone for at the Corbridge Estate site near the airport. Question is, there may be a better zone for it. I don't think we're there at the moment in terms of the evidence before the panel, but my submission is that RVZ isn't the right zone there. What Miss Grace has done has proposed some suggested drafting that would need to go into that chapter, the RVZ chapter, if the panel was to recommend a new RVZ be located in what is the rural zone RCL at the moment. So as we covered this morning, if that rezoning was successful, it would no longer be rural zone RCL. The RCL falls away.
And her evidence seems to be supporting, and maybe I've interpreted wrongly, if she can answer this, the fact that there could be an RVZ in the RCL, that there can be appropriate sites. That when you look at the wording of the RVZ, it doesn't preclude that, or it could be amended and still remain a coherent zone. Is that her position?
Yes, I understand it is. And I mean, by providing that drafting, she's seeking to assist you in providing it.
She's doing more than just assisting us, isn't she? She's actually saying this is okay.
Well, it turns on whether any rezonings are recommended. If no rezonings are successful in the RCL, then
not really, because people could come along with private plan changes in the future and find a perfect site, if we don't.
Well, I think she has perhaps sought to clarify that, if I recall rightly, in her maybe it's in her rebuttal, okay. But that drafting is provided on the basis that we have a RVZ in the rural character landscape. If there isn't, then we can revert to the pure ONL language. There's a...
She could clarify whether she's suggesting that.
Certainly.
That it's appropriate, maybe not necessarily in any of the sites we've got before us now, or whether she's just saying, if you find it appropriate on any of the sites before us, then you would need to put this word in it.
Certainly. That's all. Okay. It is after 5. Would you like me to carry on?
Why don't you carry on to the end of your section 6.
Okay. So under the heading existing environment, this is something I wanted to just cover at the outset, and it's an issue that's arisen through previous hearings on this plan, in particular on rezoning submissions. The Chair will be familiar with it. What a number of submitters have attempted to do during the course of their evidence and presentations to the panel is apply the Hawthorne existing environment concept to this process. Of course, the Hawthorne existing environment concept is a resource consent principle essentially created by the courts. And what it does is it allows a consideration of a future state of the environment rather than the decision date. When a resource consent has been granted and it appears that those resource consents will be implemented. So there's been some tension in previous hearings as to whether this concept applies here. The one decision which has considered this is out of this district, Shotover Park Limited and others and Queenstown Lakes District Council, and there the High Court confirmed that when you're plan making, the decision maker is not obliged to consider the environment by reference to the tests contained in the Hawthorne decision. So it's not mandatory, but the council has a discretion to take it into account, which is what the panel will need to do for certain submissions. That discretion has to be exercised on a principled basis, and I guess one of the key factors there is evidence as to whether a particular consent is being implemented or is likely to be implemented. Why am I addressing this? It's because we have submissions that, for example, have a existing resource consent that has a structure plan attached to it, or they have a resource consent which allows them to do certain activities.
Okay, Arcadia.
Exactly, Arcadia. And they are saying, well, you can ignore the adverse effects of what we already have consented. My submission to you is you can only ignore the adverse effects of what has been consented if you are satisfied that that consent is likely to be implemented. If it's not, then the existing environment needs to be considered without that resource consent.
Is that the only question? Because as you say, there's a discretion. If it's not likely to be implemented, then that's an easy decision to make, because you wouldn't pass an existing environment test even if you applied it. But you've also got to decide whether it's appropriate to apply an existing environment rubric.
Yes, I'd agree with that. Yes. That there is another sort of factor to this, in that if you do apply the existing environment concept, that means you will disregard some adverse effects. In my submission, you must also disregard any positive effects of implementing that resource consent. If you don't, the submitter is essentially double dipping in terms of those positive effects.
In going back to Corbridge, there seems to be, it's not clear, we're yet to see Ms. Irving's legal submissions. They seem to be sidling up to an existing environment argument. It seems rather difficult to say, on one hand, we can rely on the existing environment and then seek a zone that would provide for something entirely different.
Well, that's exactly it. These submitters are saying, well, we've got this much, so you can disregard that, but actually what we want is some other zone type. It's one or the other.
Well, it's almost like, are they saying that they're not likely to use the zone, but and they really want the consents, because if they are likely to use the zone, by definition, they're not likely to use the consent, therefore it's not within the existing environment.
I can't speak to what they're saying, but...
Well, we will ask Ms. Irvin that question.
But my submission, I guess that this concept is available, but I do urge caution and when you do apply it, because the consent needs to be likely to be implemented or not.
So isn't the follow-on from that in the same way we would have to consider if we were here hearing a resource consent in the case of an approved resource consent? The test would be, can the two consents coexist? Otherwise, the existing consent won't. Isn't it now the same principle of the proposed plan change provisions would have to be able to coexist with the granted consent?
I'd
or
agree
it falls
with
flat?
That. That's a good way of putting it. Yep. Okay, so just the final matter to address today. This is under the heading comparison point for submissions seeking rezoning to different zone. It is was raised this morning in a question from the chair to Mr. Barr. Essentially, what the question is, which objectives are we looking at? And where we have a rezoning request from rural zone to rural visitor zone, the comparison point in terms of the objectives have to be the strategic objectives of the plan. So the question there is the rural zone or is the RVZ zone or is something in the middle the most appropriate zone to achieve the objectives? I carry on to say here that that's not the end of the exercise, because you can't complete that exercise in isolation from the provisions within the zones themselves. So if you are, I'm going to use the rural visitor zone as an example again, if you are to apply the rural visitor zone, the rules within the rural visitor zone will be applied to the land in question. And through section 76.3 of the RMA, the panel must have regard to the actual or potential effects on the environment of any activities that would apply through the application of a rule. So the panel needs to also consider carefully what can be provided within that rural visitor zone and what the effects on the environment of those activities that are allowed, particularly in my submission when we're in an ONL, Section 6B landscape.
Or to refer back to a recent discussion, or within a Wahi Tupuna, given the instruction in the RPS to avoid significant adverse effects?
Yes. And just to wrap that up, in my final paragraph, it's accepted that there's no statutory presumption that a notified zone is more appropriate than one sought through a submission. But in my submission, a submitter still needs to provide a level of detail and analysis that corresponds to the scale and significance of the environmental effects that are anticipated from the implementation of the new zone sought. And to give an example of that, there are some rural visitor zone, it's a common theme, requests within the ONL where the council's landscape evidence in chief gave some pretty clear indications of the level of detail that might assist. Some of the submitters have done quite a good job of providing that.
And some have not.
And some have not. That's correct. So it's important that that is available to the panel when it's considering the actual or potential adverse effects of the rules in those particular zones.
Thank you, Ms. Scott. Do you intend to present your Stream 17 specific submissions before we kick off with the design guideline team?
Perhaps we get through the design guideline topic first and then they can leave. I'm happy to answer any legal questions on that first, Commissioner Munro.
We might come armed with couple of questions for you in advance before we talk to the witnesses.
Certainly.
But we'll proceed on the basis that those are preliminary questions that are relevant to the design guideline evidence that will follow, and then we'll hear So we're here, your design guideline team, then have your written submissions, then carry on with the rest of Stream 17. Commissioner Cheetham will leave us this evening, escape back to the winterless north. But thank you very much for you and your team. Scott's been a somewhat dampened day. The commissioner beside me has had a stressful start to the day.
Sorry, everybody.
But we will return at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Thank you.
Can everyone leave their papers as they are?
Oh, yes. Question? Lock. Room will be locked. Thank you very much. But you can talk tomorrow at 9 a.m.
What about this bit?